Hello and welcome to Minter Dialogue, episode number 422. My name is Minter Dial and I'm your host for this podcast. This week's interview is with Christine McKay. Christine is a worldly entrepreneur, speaker, and the award-winning founder of Salamandra, animation studios that help organizations to convey complex messages using a variety of state-of-the-art technologies. In this discussion with Christine, we look at animation trends and how the techniques have evolved, the variety of options that it allows in crafting stories and messages, how animation can be used to effectively communicate more difficult and complex subjects, including education, sensitive issues, and of course, entertainment. You'll find all the show notes on MinterDial.com. Please do consider to drop in your rating and review, and don't forget to subscribe to catch all the future episodes. Now for the show. Christine McKay, how lovely to have you on the show. I must say, I think this is a first, an expert in animated videos. You're an award-winning founder of the animation studios that's based in an old town I know well, Eton, as well as up north in Dundee. You're an entrepreneur and an international speaker, and you run this company called Salamandra.uk. In your own words, how would you like to describe yourself, Christine?
Well, Minter, thank you very much for having me on board today. So we describe ourselves as visual problem solvers. We like to say that we convey complex messages for our clients in B2B primarily, using animation on any platform. So if you want it onto a rocket, we can do that too. We work with a whole stack of different businesses, small and large, and we use, animation-wise, we use 2D, 3D, augmented reality, virtual reality, mixed reality, motion graphics, stop motion, and then, of course, we work on branding and design as well. So anything to do with visual problems, challenges, what have you, we're the people to go to. We've got an amazing team. They're agile, fun, creative, and everything's done in-house. So it's huge fun. Although we've got the two studios, as you mentioned, Minter, we do work collaboratively between the two studios. And now working remotely, we've actually become more productive, believe it or not.
Love it.
Pretty crazy. Well,
So now I want to start with your background a little bit, Christine, because I would say kindred spirit in terms of completely colossally weird and diverse countries you've been brought up, languages that you speak. Tell us a little bit about your journeys thus far in life, Christine.
Right. Well, I have to praise it quite a bit. Like yourself, I'm sort of multicultural in the sense of my parents. My father was a pure Scot, but my mother's side is a complete tutti-frutti. Everything from Anglo-German, Brazilian, Italian, you name it. It's really quite complex. I grew up in Portugal, a beautiful place to grow up and a lovely place to be a child. Had a French education, finished my schooling in England and then university, etc. And then jumped in an old combi with my then boyfriend and drove across Africa, zigzagging across the continent, ended up in Southern Africa and working very much into sort of nine territories in that area. But actually, I'd sort of by then traveled in about, I think it's 35 of the 55 African countries, so quite a bit, but it's beautiful. And I've traveled quite a bit just generally, just to have fun. I was even actually in the, I think it was a 1991 carnival in Rio, just I was part of the whole thing, the headdress, the boots, the singing the samba down the samba drum, the whole thing. So I lived and worked in South Africa for a bunch of years. Then we moved to New Zealand and then we then moved back to the UK. So it's been a sort of round the world trip, really. And it's been wonderful because really having to experience different markets, you know, the markets are all very different. Business is done very differently and in exciting ways. And you kind of learn from that. You learn from the different cultures and the different people. I mean, South Africa's got 11 official languages and it's marvelous. It's so diverse. And their kind of business is, it's a bit like I imagine it must be in America where anything's possible. I mean, people aren't jaded or sort of cynical. It's you have an idea, they go, great, how are we going to do that? You know, whereas I think in Europe, it tends to be more mature market, a little bit more staid in a way. You know, it's proven its point and it's done really well. But I think maybe new ideas aren't quite so welcome. I don't know.
But yeah, it speaks to the power of diversity. And when you look at in Africa, they sometimes have leaped
over certain technologies. Plus, they have the bootstrapping as a core manner of doing business. And that kind of an attitude lends you to be more innovative and presumably more efficient as far as making the end product less expensive.
Absolutely. I've seen some incredible innovation. I remember we broke down in Zaire, or we first broke down in Centrafrique in the Combi, and then limped along to Zaire. It was still Zaire in those days. And we had a real problem because it's an air-cooled engine using, I think it's 2 or 3 litres of oil. It's very little. And that was where the leak was, and that's why we seized the engine. Anyway, long story short, a 14-year-old boy local to the area, who'd been trained by a Belgian engineer, I think, came up with a solution. He used, believe it or not, a sardine tin, cut out a sort of a washer shape, and put it to bung up the where it was leaking, where the rubber was leaking and the oil. Anyway, long story short, we managed to get to sort of the next town and get it fixed and what have you. We actually we broke the Guinness Book of Records by being towed. The longest tow, we got towed through 3 countries, which is pretty bonkers, but there you go.
Nice one. So in your journey, you've landed on animated videos.
Yes.
How did that happen?
Well, I've always been a very visual person. In fact, my first ever crush as a child was a cartoon character called Marine Boy that my sister and I used to fight over.
He's mine. No, he's mine.
Exactly right. So I think that I'm one of my friends in New Zealand when we lived there ran an animation firm, and I absolutely loved what they did. And when I moved back to the UK, I realized that there was a gap in business for animation as a fantastic way to convey those complex messages, be understood in a snap, and really get that message across. So that's when I started Salamandra here in the UK and focus very much on animation as a form of a very malleable, agile way to communicate. And there are so many different ways that animation can be used in business or education for that matter, because apparently we process images 60,000 times faster than text. It takes us 13 milliseconds to absorb an image. And that, you know, if you're trying to explain something, if you're trying to read something, it takes so much longer. And if you have any kind of learning disabilities or reading disabilities, that's much, much a bigger ask. Whereas, you know, we're built to our brain is a third of our brain is built for vision. So, you know, that's kind of a very fast way to get that message embedded and understood. And it stays in your long-term memory, which is even better.
Mm. So, the name Salamandra, of course, it attracted me for a couple of reasons, other than it being odd. It's a different, you know, so it's a combination word. I went to a business school whose emblem was a salamander. My college at Yale in United States was also had the salamander. So somehow it's been around me. So I felt inclined to talk about the salamandra. Tell us about how you came up with your salamandra. For those, you can't see this because this is an audio recording, but behind you is your animated salamandra doing its moves, presumably a little bit of the rumba, the samba. Anyway, it's very fun.
Yes, no, thank you. He's a very popular character. He's our mascot, Sal, obviously short for salamandra, and he's a 3D character that we use in lots of different environments. And the name came up from an old nickname, actually. My sister's old nickname, her name's Sandra, and was in Portuguese, Sandra is Sandra, and salamandra in Portuguese is salamandra. So Sandra, salamandra, it's very sort of similar. So that's one of her nicknames, and it's been really popular. I love lizards anyway, any kind of lizard. I think one of my favorites is the one in New Zealand, which is bright green and doesn't have eyelids, so it uses its tongue as a windscreen wiper, and it's the funniest thing you've ever seen. I just think they're very friendly characters, and they're good for the environment, and I don't know, people just seem to resonate with it. And of course, being a bunch of lizards, we call it the Lizard Lounge, so we're, you know, Salamandra has its own Lizard Lounge. And yeah, apparently I've just recently found out that having some kind of mascot improves the recognition of your business or your brand by 6.7%, which is incredible. 6.7 times, I beg your pardon.
Right.
So it is actually quite a valuable thing to have. We like it because it's very engaging and people comment on his personality. We're now building a whole brand Bible around him and his backstory and everything else. So it definitely gives you marketing legs.
It does. I mean, when you said 6.7%, I was thinking, oh God, that's one of those marketing claims that can't possibly be justified. But it, I mean, obviously you need to have some sort of impersonization or elements that are coherent with your mascot. Otherwise it's sort of, you know, mascot for mascot's sake.
Yes. Absolutely. I think,
You write, you are a lizardly lot of parrot tamers and shark divers, narrow boat natives and dragon keepers. So we're rather flowery language.
Yeah, well, that's actually all true with regards to our team. We all do that. It's true of what our guys do. So whether they were brought up on a narrowboat or what have you, or have tamed parrots or what have you, it's all true.
So you mentioned before how video, you know, there's so many different expressions of it. It says thousands and millions of words, millions of messages that we can capture. Mm-hmm. How would you otherwise describe the general rise of video in our lives?
I think that we're all time poor and we have a lot to absorb, whether that be for fun or for business or, you know, for learning purposes. And doing something visually, it's something that we are instinctively drawn to as that sort of primeval part of our brain. And as I say, it does stay in your long-term memory. So it is incredibly useful for getting complex messages across. You can use animation can be a very, as opposed to film, it's got a lot of advantages. One, you can create it completely remotely, which in this particular climate is great. And it can be really created by teams all around the world. I mean, our team do happen to be in the UK, but they could actually be anywhere. So you can it can be used for sensitive subjects, whether it be talking about, for example, funerals or abuse. It can be used for it can be genderless and culturalless. It's a great way to you can convey something quite complex in an abstract way. You can go back in time into the future. You can become, you know, an amoeba. You can go into a piece of engineering. You can, you know, explain, demonstrate something in a sort of small space environment that you couldn't use film, for example. You can. It really is very, very malleable, very diverse. There's lots of different ways of using it, particularly for education, and education, be that for commerce or tertiary or primary or secondary education. It holds your attention span longer. We've all so used to lots of, you know, being bombarded with lots of different information. It's one way of keeping you engaged. So, for example, we do a lot of animated presentations now for business. So instead of, you know, death by PowerPoint, we can actually create, you know, slides which animate from one to the other. So it feels like you're watching almost like a film, if you like. It's seamless, but it's clickable. So you go to the next section when you're ready to talk. Again, it just is another way of bridging that gap between face-to-face or in-person to, you know, long distance or Zoom, what have you. We've also found that clients are more and more wanting us to create their 3D virtual auditoriums and multi-screen stuff. The stuff that we used to do in person for overseas or local conferences, we're now doing completely virtually for clients, where we'll create the environment to feel that you're actually in this virtual auditorium, and then the actual animations or presentations that go on the multi-screens themselves. The other thing that we've been doing, which is a lot of fun, is we can green screen ourselves or our clients and then put them in a completely virtual environment where bonkers things can be happening. You can have, you know, screens that come down, 3D graphs to really complement what you're saying. We've had Sal walking on the virtual stage, stomping across in his little, you know, a personality walk and stuff. And you literally, you can do absolutely anything. You can create completely virtual environments. You can have half and half. You can use augmented reality, where you can potentially use, say, a QR code, which, you know, back in vogue. And then you can create something that comes out at you from the screen or from a printed matter in 3D. You can see it on your tablet or your phone and look all the way around it. You can anchor it to the real world environment, walk around it, see the whatever the animation or the instructional thing unfold. And it's just much more it just involves you a lot more. And now, probably jumping a bit here, but with VR particularly, it's really exciting what can be done from a demonstration purposes. So if you've had this massive conference that you wanted to have all these people from around the world attend, and now it's not happening, well, why not create it in a virtual environment, a completely virtual environment where, you know, for the price of a ticket, a flight to London to Paris or London to Cannes, for example, you can send your VIPs a headset with controllers and then invite them to a virtual demonstration where you can have other avatars of your staff, for example, coming to explain how something works, answer questions, blah, blah, blah. They can be salespeople, engineers, you name it. So it brings up a whole new world of possibilities with regards to demonstrations, whether that be pharmaceuticals. We were up for a couple of awards, actually, for a campaign we did for a big pharmaceutical, UK pharmaceutical, that had an infant, can't give you too many details because it's under NDA, but an infant disease that it was a campaign that started just in the UK. It was using AR, placing a sort of a, basically a cot in your own environment where the child's illness develops. It's quite emotive, it's quite emotional. And the client himself was very moved because he's a parent himself. The child then transitions under sort of a time lapse into a hospital environment, and then what happens there. And that was really used to explain to clinicians, without being able to show them or be there personally, how something works and how, you know, these how, you know, the pharmaceutical could help. And it was so popular that had such a huge effect that it went to Europe, then it went to whole EMEA, went to Australasia, became a sort of global thing. And we then obviously amended and localized the animation to suit each territory. And just shows how it really can be used for any industry. It can be used for education particularly. I think it's a fantastic tool, whether that's internal for, you know, health and safety and HR for business, or for primary, secondary, tertiary education. What better way, especially now if you are having to learn remotely, to engage and immerse people in learning in a way that, especially young people, that they're all on YouTube normally, and they learn stuff from YouTube. It's a so the new way of learning. So why not incorporate that into your actual courseware in a way that's you know, more immersive?
Right. Well, you've said a lot of things there, and I want to just unpack a couple. I want to start with this notion of sensitive material. Mm-hmm. And for having done a film myself, so I kind of feel like I'm aware of the power of video and the immediacy of the pathos that can be brought around, and also the challenge with actors. You know, hey, you should act sad, you know, or you should act with pathos. It's a complicated thing for actors to get across, especially if they're not professional in a documentary format, or a business person, you're trying to have them do a speech that's supposed to be with gravitas, but doesn't necessarily come. So when you're doing these animations, how do you approach sensitive topics? What is it that allows for animation to come across? Do you need to have a little bit of lightness, humor, in a medium which can quickly lead to too much at some level?
Well, like any kind of film, our animations do have story arcs, even though they might be, you know, say business orientated, for example. Although we're getting asked more and more to do more entertainment and children's stuff. But so that story arc will help with, you know, where there's a sort of rush of emotion, or there's a lightness or heaviness or what have you. But it all starts really with the briefing. We get to the first thing we ask a client is, what is your challenge and what are you trying to do? Who are you trying to speak to? Why? And what do you want them to do? What's their call to action, really? And once we understand that, we can start on the script. And the script may not have a voiceover. It might just be the actual storyline. Most of the time we do use voiceovers, and that helps with the emotion, if you like. And voiceover artists are actors, and they know exactly how to inflect and how to get that pathos or how to get the lightness, and that timing and the cadence is crucial. So animation is one thing. So the visual is one thing, but the sound and everything that goes with it, whether it be the voiceover, the music, whether it's sound effects, etc., are equally important. And the two together is what makes such a powerful package. What we, for us, first prize is if we're able to compose a piece for our animations. It's not always possible. It's usually down to budget. If we can't compose a piece, and the reason we prefer that is that we can really work to the cadence and ensure that it works with that emotional thing. And it could be sort of an epic feeling or a sad feeling or, you know, just a sort of, you know, humming along feeling. But we can achieve that, and we do very, very frequently with royalty-free music that we go and search for and find something that's appropriate, and then we animate to it. So just to show you how the sound is so important, we have to have the voiceover and the music nailed at the same time as the actual script and the storyboard, so that the two things marry. So we animate to the sound to make sure that the two things marry up, and there is, wow, that sort of story arc, if you like. It is important to do that accurately. Sound is very important, and you're right in the sense that often, you know, business owners or people ask whether they can be part of the voiceover or the acting, and we, if it's, you know, really something they want, then we'll go with it. We'll push back and we'll say, look, you guys aren't actors, you might come across as wooden, why don't we use a professional voiceover to have that? Plus they do it much faster as well. They'll do it in one or two takes. Whereas when you do it with people who aren't professional, it might take quite a few takes.
Yeah, well, the challenge of course is going to be saying it without ruffling feathers, you know.
Of course.
You know, I'm brilliant. So with regard to animation, you mentioned AR, augmented reality, virtual reality, mixed reality. What would you say are the trends that are happening? I mean, let's say just broadly speaking, what about animation as a subset of video? Is it a growing part? I mean, video is growing so fast. Is an animation a growing segment within video, or growing along with video, or growing less fast than video in general?
I would say it's faster. I mean, there's so many applications to animations, whether that be gaming, which is absolutely colossal, as you know.
Of course.
Whether it's, you know, for business purposes, whether it's for entertainment, whether it's for education, all those things. The great thing about animation is, unlike a film shoot, where if you want to make changes down the line or you want to add on to it, you've got to get the whole film shoot back, the same, you know, weather, you know, parameters, the same environment, etc. With an animation, you can change it 5 years down the line, 10 years down the line. It really doesn't matter. I mean, obviously the technology will have changed by then because it's changing very swiftly and getting better and better. But the point is that it's a much more cost-effective way to, if you're likely to want to change something, to do it via animation. It's also one thing that we've really noticed is, you know, our brains are wired when we see a photograph or a film of a person to make instant judgments. We instantly have a backstory to that person. You know, we judge them on, I don't know, everything, what they wear, their class, their background, their accent, etc. Whereas with an animation, our brain isn't wired to do that. So it becomes much more neutral and you'll get much more buy-in. So people start listening to the message rather than focusing on the person. And that, I think, is much more powerful than, you know, you could have, for example, David Attenborough. Let's take some very, very famous, and people will immediately think, oh, he's such a great guy. But you'd be thinking about him and you're not really thinking about what he's saying, or you'll get distracted, put it that way. Whereas if it was a, you know, an animation of a person who may look like him or even might sound like him, it's not him. So you're not thinking, oh, you know, he's such a good dude and he's a national treasure, blah, blah, blah. You're thinking about, what is that character saying? And what are they trying to get across? So it's very powerful from that perspective. We are born with these instinctive knee-jerk reactions. And, you know, we can't help it. It's just the way we're built. So I think animation can really help with that. Plus, in it, you don't have to use humans. You can use shapes or abstract form or just or even just use motion graphics and actually lettering that's animated to reflect what you're saying. So there are lots of different ways where you can really drill that message down, really sort of get the person's imagination and that message across, whatever that may be.
When you mentioned Attenborough, I was thinking of his voice, and he has such a lovely voice. I feel like that's a reusable voice that brings with it some gravitas. It doesn't necessarily throw me into his personality per se. Whereas when you take music that has been used before, that's like Me Too, or, you know, that you can use royalty-free music that others have used, and you're like, oh no, not that jingle again. And then having some unicity to the music is interesting. In feature-length film, typically, as I understand it, film is the last thing. You layer on the composer if it's done originally. It's taking it, looking at the whole thing and adapting to what's going on the screen in order to make the beat match what's happened in the filming. Whereas, as you were saying, it happens coincidentally with the making of, because it's really a symbiotic relationship in the creative process.
Mm. Yeah, I think it's very collaborative because I guess with a composition, you sort of get a flavor of what it might sound like. But to have that whole story arc, it's really important to, you know, because the storyboard is something which is, you know, it's a work in progress until the client signs it off. So, you know, the composer might be playing around with sort of different cadences and stuff. I mean, at the end of the day, they'll have the building blocks to create the final piece. But there is a little bit of back and forth to get it right. And also, once you get it right, you know, depending on the client, there may be, you know, a number of sort of sign-offs within the company. And you may, the idea is not to get to that point. We get client sign-off all along the way. But you never know. Sometimes there's always a spanner in the works where somebody doesn't like a particular part of the music or what have you. It doesn't often happen, but yeah, it is a collaborative process, and I think it's an organic one. I think it needs to be, because you're really getting across a whole story.
Yeah, and so that creative input is always complicated when you have an executive that says, "Well, I don't like that music." I mean, what don't you like about it? Every other note. to use a reference to Amadeus, when you have this sort of extraordinary vastness of possibilities, I feel like it's a little bit daunting. You talk about you can basically do anything. For an executive, it's almost like that's just even more complexity. As it is, I usually don't have the ability to simplify my message, and we can do anything. It feels like an endless opportunity, a field of dreams for a creative. So talk us through how you move from complexity to simplicity.
Well, we've got very robust systems. We've got a very robust briefing process where we ask lots and lots of questions. We look at the brand, what the product or service is. We look at competition, the industry. We, as I say, ask lots of questions. We have to totally understand if it's a B2B animation, for example, have to totally understand what the product or the brand does before we can even begin on a narrative. Then once we kind of understood that and we've nailed down we ask clients to give us, say, bullet points of what they would like included in the script. But we then finesse that into a script because we know how many words. For example, a 60-second animation, you're playing with about 50 to 90 words, it's not very much, but we're really good at distilling that into something that works. But then that's accompanied by the voiceover, motion graphics, what's going on in the animation, et cetera, et cetera. So there's a lot more richness involved in that. We then also, once we've done our research, we create what we call a mood board, and we get a whole stack of different styles and color schemes and fonts and everything else. We present that to the client, and then they let us know, oh, we love that color scheme, love that style, don't like so much that, we'd love to marry this with that, etc. And then we start to see what's in their head, and then we can start with, you know, the style sheet and what it might look like. The script helps with the storyboard, the voiceover. We can recommend, you know, male, female, child, received pronunciation, regional accent, any language you want under the sun, what have you. And that's another thing. Animation is great if you're international because you can change the voiceover to any language. And then once that's all signed off, the trickiest part, obviously, is that there's quite a bit of work that goes into the storyboard because we've got to work out how to visually represent what we're saying and then how to transition from one element to another from an animation perspective. And that takes a lot of skill. Because not only are you trying to get across the message, but you've got to do it visually, and you've got to do it in an appealing visual way that makes sense and that goes with the story or the narrative that you're trying to get across. So once that's approved, then we start creating the assets. That's the actual drawing of the elements. They get prepared for whatever type of animation we're going with, whether it's 2D, 3D, a mixture of the two, whether it's going to go on to AR or VR, you know, we know all that up front. That's all been, agreed up front. And then, and only then do we start the animation. And again, we will send little snippets to clients. If it's quite a complicated piece, we will do what we call an animatic. And that we don't normally share with a client because it's a complete pastiche and it looks, well, from an outsider's perspective, it looks absolutely awful. I remember sending an animatic to a client in the past and they went, oh my God, this isn't what I asked for. This is just hideous. And all it is basically using the storyboard, which looks a bit like a cartoon, and then animating it very slightly with, you know, hand-drawn bits to show where it's where the things are happening with the voiceover or the music so that you can see how it will work in a very sort of jaggedy way, if you like. There's no animation, proper animation per se, but then it helps with the flow to see that it all works and that the timing's correct. Otherwise, you get animators who might spend too long on a piece that is a lot shorter or too short an animation for something that's longer. It all depends on what the voiceover is doing and the music, et cetera, et cetera. So that's usually only used internally. That's an animatic. And then once we've got the animatic, then it really helps to shape where to animate and how and what elements to put in, et cetera.
Yeah, I've had that experience when I worked at L'Oreal where agencies would come in with, hey, listen, what I'm about to show you isn't the final product. It's just a concept board. It's an abstraction of what we want to do. And just people just get so tied up on, wait, that blue is not right. Yeah, we want a blue, not necessarily that blue.
Yeah.
And we get tied up in it. You mentioned languages. And of course, being a linguist like myself, you will surely know that some languages take longer to write than others. And so in the brief, presumably, it's important to know that because if you need to expand into languages that are a little bit more long-winded, then you need to make sure that the animation mouth speaks at a time space that will fit for French.
Exactly. I mean, they may not have a mouth, you know, we can synchronize it and we can change that for every language. So we can actually change out the mouth area if you want it synchronized to the speech. We had that recently, actually. We had a job with a client in Hong Kong and they were creating something for Japan. And Japanese is obviously a lot longer than English. And the voiceover timing was quite different. So, but you're absolutely right. And even for written campaigns, if you're doing any kind of campaign into, say, for example, EMEA, Russian is a lot longer than, say, English or even Spanish. And Portuguese is a lot longer than Spanish. So it's kind of, you're quite right. You need to know upfront and then work accordingly. So say, for example, you've got a voiceover for something that's going to go into Russian, do the Russian one first. That's going to be the longest. And then work back to the English.
That's funny. And of course, when you write, whether it's characters, then if you're writing in Chinese, that's much shorter than the more flowery German or whatever. That's most interesting. So in terms of technologies, first of all, when it comes to the animations per se, I'm wondering to what extent artificial intelligence is now being used. You've seen how, in Disneyland, the old Disney, in the old days by hand, each calc led to one movement to another. And then afterwards, they started benefiting from a base animation and then using it for other animations. But it was still very manual. Today, when someone's imagining the movement of a character, are we at the stage where we can sort of say, walk with a funny gait to the right, kind of thing, and the animation is then, or the AI or some kind of automation allows for that, or does that all happen by hand? Give us a little bit of an understanding of how that happens.
You're quite right. I mean, in the old days, it was all hand-drawn, and if you wanted any changes, you literally had to redraw everything. Now, 2D animations are done in vector animation, so it's something that you can amend, and that's why it is cost effective to do it in animation because you can amend it. We still get asked to do hand-drawn animation. We have done it. We've been award-winning in a couple of the things that we've done, and it does look beautiful. It just takes longer, and also if there are any changes, that could be quite costly. So we veer, if clients really want it, we'll say, absolutely, we can do it. These are the criteria. You know, you've got to make sure that, you know, there's sort of a buffer zone for that. But with regards to other types of animation, it's the software nowadays is fantastic. And we are now, we use a number of different platforms and they all do very different things. So the platforms use physics, for example, to work out if you're doing a drop or a teardrop or a piece of a drop of honey, for example, landing. It uses physics to work out how the movement should work. So it's actually quite technical these days, and you can program quite a lot in. For example, Sal at the back here, who's doing his little samba, a lot of what he does has been programmed in, and it's, although he's completely rigged and he's been built in 3D, and so that all the movements can work and his eyes work and blink and everything else, and he breathes, the movements are done in on a platform that allow us to do it more easily, should we say, than having to draw every little piece. The other thing which is really exciting, and we absolutely love this, we can't wait to do more and more of it, is that we're working on platforms now that we can create animations where you can decide the outcome. So a little bit like the Black Mirror, the Bandersnatch episode, where you could pick the different outcomes and you could have different endings. Well, you can do that now in animation, and you can, for example, let's take a children's episode. You can, at the touch of a button, change the language, change the characters, change the season, change the outcome, and it's all in real time. So that's really, really exciting. And we get such a kick out of all the developments because, you know, I think lockdown's just made everything come in bubbling up to the surface. I mean, software companies and hardware companies are falling over themselves to make the platforms more user-friendly, more versatile, more affordable, you know, even sort of all the tech like the headsets and everything else, they're much more affordable than they used to be. And, you know, HoloLens and all that kind of stuff that's just getting better and better and better. And it's very, very exciting because it'll help us in all sorts of things. I mean, they're already using those kind of platforms for example, Boeing engineers are using that to have hands-free voice activated instructions on how to change all the wiring in their planes. And, you know, that kind of stuff, it's already happening. So, and that's using, you know, projected animation onto real world while they're making their changes, etc. So there's, for example, you know, virtual what do they call those escape rooms that you can do now, which again are sort of completely technical. They're using the new platforms and again it's in real time. So lots and lots of exciting stuff going on. I can't tell you, we're super excited about it.
Well, yeah, that comes through, Christine. So in terms of the innovation, I'm wondering where that's happening most. You mentioned gaming. I can imagine the Toy Story version 16 or whatever going to be coming up in the future. There's lots going on within the movie industry. You talked about education and business in general, using it for example, training modules. I'm imagining that's a little bit less innovative and more, you know, practical. Where is the innovation happening that's really driving the industry?
I'd say gaming. Gaming is one of the biggest, it's got a massive amounts of money being poured into it. In fact, Dundee, where one of our studios is, they're looking to build an esports stadium there, which is very exciting. And of course, Dundee is the gaming mecca of the world, I believe, or one of them. So gaming is definitely leading the way in lots and lots of different things, whether it be the software that helps to build the games, because obviously it's in real time. It's about reducing the size of it so that you can still have a seamless experience while you're taking part in the game, because these are massive files, and they've over the years have sort of made it through technology and improvements. They've made it smaller and able to get onto your, you know, your hardware to enable you to play these things. And again, in real time, and you're playing with people around the world. I would say that is the biggest front runner. That and probably, you know, industries such as pharmaceutical that need to share, or even engineering. Engineering is becoming very, very digitized. They're now testing things digitally without having to build them, which is, again, is very exciting. So using animation to build things digitally, it speeds everything up. It means that you can prototype things virtually without having to build them, anything from cars to machinery to planes or what have you. It means that it comes to market that much faster. It's much cheaper because people aren't having to actually build it, you know, in bricks and mortar or steel and, you know, metal. It's actually all digital until It's gone through all the sort of algorithms and AI testing, etc., before they even build it. So it means that all sorts of things are speeded up. So pharmaceuticals, I imagine there's a lot going on there with testing things digitally, whether it be, you know, vaccines or any kind of, medical device, or just, you know, in general. I think it's helping any industry. As I say, we work in over 17 industries, from air traffic control companies to, you know, startup consultancies to, you know, catering, hospitality, engineering, IT. I mean, all those things, or any industry would make use of kind of animation.
So I've seen a lot of different VR applications and visualization. And of course, you have the training for pilots and all this. The area that's of interest to me also is in therapy. As we've been mentioning pharmaceuticals.
Yes.
When you talk to an individual, there's the human-to-human relationship, but there is increasingly opportunities to speak to machines. And while some people might think that's an anathema to the human being, there is some evidence that says that we can speak to machines better, especially if they listen more. But when on top of that, the machine is reacting to you in a way that is interesting to you and engages you, I'm just wondering what type of experiences you've seen using animation in therapy.
Well, I've seen it used in training for care, for elderly care, for example, where basically you're put in a situation, and again, it's using VR, but it's interactive. So you have somebody coming up to you who's angry or sad or whatever, and you have to respond to that and deal with it. And sort of you get tested on that, if you like. I've also seen it used very well for charities, where you get more empathy for understanding the environment or the you know, why you're helping a particular charity, what is it doing, and you're in situ, you're enveloped in it. I saw a very emotional and powerful VR piece on Grenfell Tower, where they did it quite beautifully, actually, where basically you had a sort of bird's eye view of the tower, and then you sort of zoomed into one of the, you know, virtual rooms where you get a couple who are being interviewed about their what their home was like. And as they talk, it gets animated on in 3D. So one couple had, lots of plants in their home. So these plants are animated on as they're talking. And basically the room grows in front of your eyes. And it's an incredibly, because you're sitting there and you're part of that, you're in that environment. It's incredibly, it's very emotional and very human at the same time. So although I don't have that experience of dealing with an actual AI robot, if you like, that you're suggesting, I imagine that could be very useful. For example, if you're wanting to speak to your GP, for example, and then a robot might say, well, you know, what are you, you know, and again, it's quite sensitive, and it's quite genderless and culturalless and all that kind of stuff. So, you know, you might feel more comfortable speaking to that, saying what your ailments might be, rather than having to, you know, talk to a receptionist in a busy area, which is a bit uncomfortable if you've got something that you don't really want everyone else to know about. So I imagine that would be very useful. And you could do that online, just like now. I find very useful that you can phone your GP now and have a phone consultation. How nice would it be to go on to your computer, see a humanoid face that says, you know, how can I help you, blah blah blah, and sort of, you know, direct you traffic wise that way, rather than, you know, a recorded message on a phone that takes you down this horrible rabbit warren.
Yeah, your call is important to us. We thank you for waiting 55 minutes. We'll be back to you shortly.
And then you get
call is important to us. Yeah, exactly. Bloody hell. So last area of chat. As a video producer, I know that certainly as a film producer, I respect and use Vimeo for much of my film. What about YouTube? I was wondering, what is in Christine's brain? What did she say when I mentioned YouTube? Does she have a positive, mediocre, negative opinion, feeling with regard to YouTube in your life?
It's YouTube's got lots of attributes. So, for example, we've got a YouTube channel, so we have our stuff on there. But we prefer Vimeo from a sort of branding perspective, in the sense that there aren't adverts, and it's a lot cleaner with regards to viewing any of our work. But all our work is now on our website anyway, pretty much, I'd say. So you don't really need to go to either. But YouTube's amazing. I mean, my kiddults learn so much stuff off YouTube. And they remember it. They spout these facts and figures and you know, these methodologies and trains of thought. And I think it's fantastic. If that is the way that young people learn or want to learn, or, well, I mean, there's obviously lots and lots of vacuous stuff on there too, which unfortunately you get that on any platform there, don't you? But there is a lot of good stuff. So I would say that it's horses for courses. So whatever your requirements are, they'll be the perfect platform for you. I'd say Vimeo is good for sort of professionally showcasing your films and your animations. YouTube is equally good in a more sort of a bigger, broader sense of a bigger audience. But again, it's different. It's a different kind of message you're sending, I think. And also the great thing about YouTube is if you have, for example, in your email signatures, if you put the URL of your animation or film in your email signature, when you send your email, it'll show a little thumbprint of that video, which all you have to do is click on it and it goes, takes you directly straight to YouTube. What a marvelous way to have an advert for every time that you send your emails, you and your staff. So we definitely encourage our clients to do that when we create animations for them. We encourage them to put that URL, and it can be hidden. It can be part of an image or something, but if you click on it, you don't have to click on it, but it appears a little thumbprint. And I think that's a fantastic tool.
Mm, lovely. And so in order, I wanted to give people a reason to go check out your website. One of the things that I liked very much was the way you presented your staff with these animated figures. Surprise, surprise. I was wondering how much input each of your employees had. And then you have this animation of them all dancing. You know, there's this wonderful sentence, dance like no one's watching you. Whoa, you're on website, you know? So when you made that animation for your staff, to present your staff with that animation like that, tell us about the process you had with the inputs of the staff, and to what extent those animated figures actually represent the way that they do move, and everyone's happy with, you know, the way it comes out.
Sure. So basically, when people join us, they send us either a photograph, or we can take it off our Zoom calls and to see what they look like. Our animator will ask, you know, what jewelry would you like? You know, potentially they might have a watch or rings or something like that they want to put on there to sort of personalize it. As you'll see from our website, you know, we don't all have colossal hands as is stylized on the characters, but they all do look like us in one format or another, pretty much. And the movements, it's just obviously very tongue in cheek, but fun. And they do actually reflect personalities, to be fair. So although people do request, I mean, we've had a new starter who requested to do the worm across. Not sure we're going to do that one, but yeah, it does reflect the personality. So it is quite a lot of fun. And I think everyone enjoys having their avatars and having them dancing as well. So it's quite a fun way to, and we change it up quite a lot. Since the last few years, we've had different look and feel to what, you know, whether it's an illustration or an animation. And also watch out for what we do to ourselves over Halloween. There's always something funny going on as well. And there's lots of backstories and Easter eggs in each of the gifts or animations around everybody's Halloween version, which is quite funny.
Rendezvous in October. All right. Well, listen, Christine, how can someone get on, find your site, find you, get in touch? What's your best ways?
So they can go onto our website, which is salamandra.uk. It's literally www.salamandra.uk. And they can reach me. I'm on LinkedIn, Christine Mackay. Or they can reach us via email on hello@salamandra.uk. So either of those ways. We're on most platforms as well. You can follow us on LinkedIn, Twitter, Instagram, Dribbble. I'm just trying to think of all the ones, all the sort of major ones and the sort of arty, filmy ones as well. So you should be able to find us hopefully quite easily.
Well, lovely. I certainly would incite anybody who's doing wanting to get it into video, doing video messages, has budget constraints, the fact that you can work from distributed with so many opportunities, especially for international sensitive topics. Wow, there's just a million reasons. Christine, it's been a pleasure to have you on. Thank you for bringing your energy to the show, and look forward to staying in touch.
Thank you so much, Minta. It's been amazing. Thanks a lot.
Thanks for having listened to this recording of the Minta Dialogue Show. You'll find the show notes and other blog posts on mintadial.com. If you enjoyed the show, please head over to iTunes to give a rating and review. And to finish, here's a song I wrote with Stephanie Singer, A Convinced Man.
Challenge, I know soon we all die. I like the feel of a stranger tucked around me, precipitating the danger to feel free. Trust in my reason and let me show you why. I'm a convinced man, practicing my lines. I'm a convinced man.
Hello, this is Gary Chachot welcoming you to check out the French History Podcast. Our main show covers the history of France from the first humans until present. If you liked Mike Duncan's The History of Rome and wanted a similar program covering the land of beauty, culture, and love, we are exactly that. We also host world-renowned scholars who have delivered guest episodes on their specialties, including 18th century pirates, revolutionary booksellers in 20th century Paris, the special friendship between the Marquis de Lafayette and Thomas Jefferson, and numerous others. Learn what you love and listen to the French History Podcast today.